ॐ ज्ञानतिमिरन्धस्य ज्ञानञ्जनशलाकाय चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः. हरे कृष्ण. Welcome everyone to the temple that never sleeps. We'll just keep the vibration going, which is our basic motto, whichever way one can. First off, for my obeisances to my spiritual master, His Divine Grace, Heisi Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, and to all the devotees who are present here today, who are very dear to Lord Krishna, having taken shelter of Him. And we've had an eventful weekend. On Friday night, we assembled at Lytton Plaza, which is on University Avenue in Palo Alto, an affluent city, and we set up a mini festival that is a celebration of the process of bhakti yoga and following the footsteps of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. We held a chanting session for several hours that was attended by around 3,000 people, several hundred at the site itself, and then several thousand more who joined us online. Of course, afterwards, even more have witnessed it, but that is the effect of the Sankirtan. So Sankirtan is a specific term which describes the process of self-realization in this age that we find ourselves in. And we do find ourselves here because perhaps we didn't sign up for it coming into this world at a particular time. We may have been unaware of the fact that we're emerging in a particular time in space. Most children are unaware, except for Shukadeva Goswami, as far as I know, who was a self-realized soul from his very birth and even before that, actually, within the womb. Prahlad also. But as we come into the world and become aware that we have a situation. What is the situation? Krishna describes in the Bhagavad Gita that along with your birth, your exit from this world is certain. It's just a matter of time. Time is ticking away. And therefore, an intelligent person, as we heard from some of the earlier presentations this afternoon, will inquire, what is the purpose of my life? And what shall I do about some of the problems that I may be experiencing in my life or I may be facing? Not the least of which is, as Prabhupada describes in his Bhagavad Gita introduction, the prospect of non-existence. I exist now, and I'm aware that I exist to a certain extent, but I'm also threatened by non-existence. He compares it to being stalked by a tigress. And around any corner, I may be devoured. So in a similar way, my death is imminent. And that could be a serious situation or problem. In fact, it could ruin your whole day, having to suddenly leave this world or even gradually leave it. Fortunately, there are answers, and there's a process through which one can elevate oneself in this life to spiritual consciousness and overcome the various problems that one faces. And in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna describes our situation in this world by saying that as soon as we come into the atmosphere of the material world, we become conditioned by the three modes of material nature. And because of those modalities, we perceive things in a certain way, we're compelled to work in a certain way, we have tastes for certain kinds of foods or music, and association and so on. And there's a way in which he also describes how when one comes in contact with devotees of Krishna, those who are already engaged in the practice of Krishna consciousness, one may become awakened to one's higher interest in life. In fact, the human frame, the human body and apparatus is specifically designed to inquire about this. This is a statement in the great bhakti scripture Srimad Bhagavatam. Kama sanendriya pritir labo jivete yavata jivasya tattva jignasya narto yash cheha karma bihi. Says that life's desire should not be aimed at sense gratification. Rather, one should take sense gratification as a means to be healthy enough so that one can inquire about one's highest good, which is spiritual. It's a different kind of activity, and it's a different way of working and thinking in the world. So all this can become realized by associating with devotees, and devotees take help from higher sources. What are the higher sources? One is called the Shastra, or the writings which have been perpetuated over millennia, and which have their origin in a non-human source. This is what is called apurusheya, which means that the instructions that come to us through the bhakti scriptures are not compiled by an imperfect being. Rather, they're eternal, and they're an emanation from the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna. And therefore, the means by which one can answer the questions of life and also take guidance in a practice that will incrementally allow one to become self-determining, not controlled by the three modalities, not dictated to by the senses, but one can actually become a free soul. And therefore, in the Gita, Krishna says, Raga dvesha vimuktaistu vishayan indriyaish charan atmavashayar vadheyatma prasadam adigashyati. That by discovering and following the principles given by the Supreme Personality of Godhead through the scriptures, which may seem restrictive at first. In fact, there's a statement by the Grihastha Vision team in ISKCON, which I've always appreciated, and that is strengthening the bonds that free us. It seems counterintuitive. However, there are ways in which, by adhering to certain principles, one actually becomes free. One may think, if I adhere to a principle, then I'm not free to do whatever I wish at any moment. But as it turns out, leaving one's senses open to following their own whims ends up in a series of whimsical events in one's life, which have no ultimate good destination and no ultimate purpose. However, if one gives attention to the instructions of Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, as an example, and follows them carefully, although at first it may seem like one is restricted, then Krishna says, this is the ultimate cause of one's freedom. Raga dvesha vimuktaistu vishayan indriyaish charan atma vashera vadeyatma prasadam arigachati. He said, by the process of carefully adhering to the instructions Krishna gives, then one gets special recognition or favor, prasadam, from the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And this is the birthright of every living entity, and which is readily available for humans who have a wide spectrum of cognition through which they can appreciate the presence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, even within their own hearts. And from that, help that comes from the Supreme, which is also mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says a similar thing again and again, Tesham satata yuktanam pachatam pritipurvakam dadami pudiyogam tam yenamam upayantite. One who sincerely tries to follow the practice of Krishna consciousness will get intelligence, spiritual intelligence directly from Krishna. So then, what is the result? How does one's life change in a positive way? The next verse tells, Prasade sarvadukhanam hanir asyopajayate prasanna cetaso yashu bhuti pariyavatishtate. And that is, when one gets the favor of the Supreme by carefully following his instructions, then one's misery goes away. The misery is killed. That's prasadi sarvadukhanam hani rasyopajayate. It means that one's misery goes away. That's an enticing prospect, don't you think? Please say yes.
Yes.
In fact, psychologists say that most human beings spend their lives more than trying to enjoy, they try to avoid misery, positioning oneself almost with a feeling of resignation that happiness is elusive, but at least don't let me suffer too much. And therefore, one might position oneself in various ways to avoid suffering as much as possible. But it visits us anyway. One can barricade oneself within a set of walls and a huge fortress, but somehow or other misery will find a way in. So how to kill that formidable enemy? Krishna gives the answer. Prasade sarvadukhanam hanira. Means that misery will be killed by the glance of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, by the favor of the Supreme. So one could try for this. And the next benefit that one gets from receiving this grace, prasanna cetaso, that means that the mind includes the heart in this, ceta means the conglomerate of the mind, the intelligence, and the heart region where we do most of our feeling. Prasanna becomes joyful. I become joyful in mind and spirit. This is a spontaneous feeling that is absolutely natural. What is unnatural is moroseness, depression, and a sense of doom, which comes about by association with a contaminated mind, a speculative mind. But by getting connection with the Supreme through yoga, bhakti yoga, one feels happy. This is, in fact, the first symptom of advancement in spiritual life. And that is that one becomes joyful. And that doesn't sound like a bad thing, does it? No? In fact, Krishna gives a definition of the breakthrough experience, which is attained by continually serving in the process of bhakti. First of all, he says that if you continue the process of bhakti, then you will rise above the influences that cause you misery. Mamcha yo vyabhicharina bhakti yogena sevate sagunan samatityaitan brahma puyaya kalpate, which means that by continuing in the process, even though it takes some effort, one will gradually rise above the three modes of material nature and come to the level of Brahman, come to the spiritual level. And this is worth trying for, because within the realm of the material world, the three modes of material nature, and within the realm of my materially oriented mind, I may make adjustments, but I'm getting the same kinds of experiences again and again. I was walking in my neighborhood this morning and thinking about how there are various combinations and permutations of living spaces that people have. Last week I was in a place on the East Coast. I happened to be in a neighborhood where the houses are bigger than a Walmart. I mean, they're like as big as a hotel. In fact, some people use them like that. In fact, I stayed in one of them. And it was practically, it was a hotel. I mean, it was that big and opulent inside, and all the trappings around it were pleasant. And then I was looking at the houses in other various neighborhoods and seeing that living entities like to sit in somewhere and live, a little roof over their houses, over their heads. But it's the same combination of wood and plaster, and you can put a few trees up, but and there is a difference in quality of life according to one's environment, but it doesn't solve all the problems of life. It doesn't bring one to a transcendent experience by rearranging the space in which we live. In and of itself, that will not complete it will not make us feel complete. We'll still feel dissatisfied eventually. In fact, sociologists have said that after you earn $160,000 a year, everything else is superfluous. I mean, you can't really do anything that much with it except for look at it and have a sense that, well, maybe I'm wealthy. In other words, within the realm of the material world and the material mind, there's a finite number of experiences that one can have. And practically speaking, they're the same thing over and over again, but just repackaged in a different way. I mean, if you go to the Rite Aid and you want to buy some, I don't know, what do you want to buy? Dental floss. There'll be six different brands of dental floss. And then Rite Aid will have its own brand as well. Different name brands, and then there's a slightly cheap. And once you pull it out of the little package, one of them says Rite Aid, and the other one has a fancy name because it's fancy because it's advertised on the television. If there still is television out there in the world, I'm not sure if it's been replaced yet. But it comes out, it's a long, thin fiber, and it's the same thing. You can't tell the difference. Just the package was different. And Prahlad Maharaj said, when he was 5 years old, he was a great master of bhakti yoga and taught to his children, and also was recorded so that it could be passed on to the rest of the world. He said, regarding the experience in the material world, punascharvita charvananam. That means it's the same experience again and again, but you're just reconfiguring the elements. It's actually kind of a fake out. I think I'm going to get something more out of it because I've changed the color, the flavor slightly, and so on. But the experience is the same. In fact, the pleasure from eating is actually a physiological reaction to certain nerves that. This was explained to us when we were in Mayapur by Narhari Prabhu, who studied the science for some time. He said there are certain pleasure points in the body, that they're nerves that get stimulated. One of them is at the back of the throat, right at the top of the esophagus. You might notice if you're ever nervous or unhappy or anything like that, your body naturally wants to take stuff and put it in the mouth so it can drop down through the esophagus. I hate to be so graphic, but that's what I'm kind of doing, giving a close reading of what takes place in life. And then I feel some temporary satisfaction. Of course, later on when I look in the mirror and I gain 50 pounds, I feel some more discontent. And in this way, in the material world, whatever I do to enjoy comes out in another way that that can take away from the experience altogether. There's a price to pay. So how to rise above that realm where I never find completion? That's described. Mam chayo vyabhicharina bhakti yogena sevate. The word seva is used. It means service. First, if one decides that there's a bigger cause, there's a cause bigger than my own little cause in life, I can't figure out what to do anyway properly. I can make so many plans, but generally they don't go the way I thought. And then I lament because I didn't get my plan didn't work exactly right, or it worked quite the opposite of what I thought it would. And so if one wants to rise above this particular realm, mamcha vyabhicharina bhakti yogena sevate. So bhakti yogena sevate, everyone please say. So bhakti comes from the root word bhaj, which means to give. It means to give of one's heart, to give out of love. And it's actually well known to everyone in the world that giving out of love is a noble principle. Taking, hoarding, coveting, these kinds of things don't even need to be expressed in rules and say don't covet and so forth, although they are, because people generally know that there's a higher principle in life. They intuit it. And so this budge is the best of what the soul can connect to, and that is this experience of giving out of love. And we call this bhakti. So there's a process called bhakti yoga. Bhakti yoga means to connect to our original divine source, Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, through acts of giving and love. And this is called bhakti yogena sevate. And this can be experienced by anyone, and this can be taken up by anyone. It's a simple process that even a child can perform, and apparently even animals can do if they are given the opportunity. So when one practices this bhakti yoga, then sagunan samatityaitan means that they rise above the three modes of material nature, much the way you would rise above the clouds when you take off in an airplane. You get on a jet and it goes faster, faster, faster along the runway, still touching the ground, we're going fast, and that's like our beginning practice in devotional service. We haven't left the atmosphere yet. We haven't left the ground even. But we know we're moving in the right direction. And then when there's enough thrust, and if there's any rocket scientists in here, please let me know. So if there aren't any, I'll just make stuff up. Go faster, faster. And at a certain point, the speed is great enough so that the airplane, according to its weight, can lift up off the ground and continue on an upward trajectory. And then, of course, in this metaphor, I'm using the lower atmosphere is the three modes of material nature, the place of misery and confusion and so forth, and recycled happiness. But above the clouds, I'm not saying you'll be happy when you get above the clouds in a plane, but in the metaphor, is a different realm where one actually experiences spontaneous happiness, joyfulness, that isn't dependent on anything else. It just is. You're happy for no reason. The only reason you're happy is because you're made of happiness. That's your actual constitution. Your constitutional nature is happiness. It's called ananda or bliss. As you're a small part of the original source of all happiness. So it makes sense that you would feel that. So mamcha yo vyabhicharena bhakti yogina sevate. Let's have a look at the verse. 14.27. In the .com era, we need to find the best of the .coms. It's in the same neighborhood. It's a good neighborhood we're in right now. I mean, even if you land in the wrong neighborhood in the Bhagavad Gita, you're still okay. So this verse says, "Mam unto me cha." Ya, a person who, and keep moving it up because I'm a little inhibited by the sunlight, as you can tell. Avyabhicharena, without fail. So this is an interesting statement also. And this is true in any kind of discipline or practice, that if you can organize your practice in such a way that you don't give it up, you don't leave wide gaps in it, then it'll be very quickly successful. You don't have to do a large quantity of any practice, but if you have consistency, then you'll be successful. And then similarly in the practice of bhakti, when you have consistency, and this is what this means, avyabhicharena, you're consistent in the practice. Bhakti yogena sevate, by this rendering of service through bhakti, sa gunan. So sa means he. And who's he? It's all of you. Anyone who's practicing, the practitioner. So you're named in this. That is, if you have the impetus to try and you would like to, you know, actually try for unfailing bhakti, then you're the he, you're the saha. So then what happens? Sagunan samatitya. Everyone say samatitya. Yeah, atitya, this means that you to rise above something else. Just like there's a devotee named Vanchatita. So vancha means desire. And atita means more than you can desire. So Vanchatita means more than you can desire. So it's one of Krishna's names. His name is the Vanchatita because he fulfills your desires more than you could expect. It's beyond what you could imagine, the way he fulfills your desire. So Sagunan Samatitya Etan. One rises above all these, and I like that he says Etan, all these modes of nature. I mean, the whole thing. When I try to solve the problems down in this realm, there's always something left over. In one of the presentations earlier today, the devotees were pointing out that you solve one problem, and even if you solve your own problem, it creates a problem for somebody else. And this is the realm we live in. It's described in the Bhagavatam. Hastani sahastanam apadani chatushpadam palguni tatramahatam jivo jiva sijivanam. That living entities who have a little more power than others feed themselves on the less powerful living entities. And it gives a description that some that have hands feed on those that don't have hands, and those that have legs can run after the ones that don't have legs, and so forth. It's actually all explained in the Nature Channel, if you watch that for a while. You see, he's like, boy, that was shocking. Bring in the kids, we can watch how one living entity eats another living entity. It's actually a quite brutal environment out there. Well organized, though, because every living entity has its particular food, but we subsist on others. And therefore it says, jivo jivasya jivanam. One living entity is food for another. It's a realm where one must live by exploitation. And when you exploit others, then you'll be exploited. This is the law of karma. And when I try to solve my problems in that realm, I simply end up exploiting others to get what I want. But there's an answer, there's a solution, and that is given here. Rise above all these modes. Give up all the ways in which you're trying to avoid misery through material adjustment or find happiness through the material adjustment, and simply rise above the modes of material nature altogether. That should do it. Yes, it does. Brahma Bhuyaya Kulpate. That person is elevated to a spiritual position. And this is the position through which one can solve all one's problems and also experience happiness. So that's where it is. So one should look for it there. And further, in the verse I was speaking about earlier, prasade sarva dukhanam hanir asyopajayate prasanna, means chetasa, means that the mind becomes happy. Buddhi pariyavadishte, and then finally it says, when one gets this input from the Supreme Personality of Godhead directly as a response to one's endeavor to practice bhakti yoga, then one also gets a steady intelligence. Well, that means that I know what to do, and I know what to avoid for my own welfare. And I'm very clear about it, and also I have the wherewithal to carry it out when I do get the intelligence. Those two things are important, because there's a way in which I may know what to do, but I don't have the strength to do it. Or I may have the strength to do things, but I don't know what to do. So both things have to be there. It's called jnana and vairagya. So in another verse in the Srimad Bhagavatam, Suta Goswami describes the benefit of practicing bhakti yoga. He says, Vasudeva Bhagavati Bhakti Yoga Prayojitaha Janayatyashu Vairagyam Jnanam Chayara Haitukam. And that is that when you practice bhakti yoga, which is a very simple thing to do, then you get, as a byproduct, natural byproduct, free gift, you get knowledge and you get detachment. And those, they have to come as a free gift, because you can't buy them anywhere. I mean, it's not something you can purchase, to get knowledge and detachment, but it comes free gift, when you practice bhakti. As Navina Nirada Prabhu was pointing out when we were in Govardhan, he gave a class and he said, when you engage in material activities, you really don't get anything ultimately. No free pen even, he said. They even don't give you a free pen. Sometimes if you go to the bank and you open an account, they'll give you a free pen. That's worth $100,000. Three pen, thank you. But when I try for material happiness, no even free pen. But so many invaluable free gifts come when one practices bhakti. Just these two that you can't buy anywhere. Even if you become a billionaire in Silicon Valley for no apparent reason, you just accidentally start a company that takes off. And people do this all the time. Say, I had no idea. I was sitting on a gold mine. It's just, I didn't know. As a lady invented some kind of, you know, pantyhose for women, and it just took off into a $1 billion business. And it's like, I don't know. I was just messing around, and it happened. So if that happens, this is an interesting turn of events. And one accidentally becomes a billionaire, suddenly, unexpectedly, you still can't get knowledge and detachment. In fact, we find all the time, we meet very wealthy people who are very interested in spiritual knowledge because, and even sometimes even more so, because when one comes to the point of reaching all of one's material goals, but then sees that I'm still in the same place I was before I had material facility, one might become even more eager to find out some different path, different answers. So knowledge and detachment, come very quickly for one who practices bhakti, the system of bhakti yoga. Again, that verse, Vasudeva Bhagavati Bhakti Yoga Prayojita Janaya Yashu Vairagyam Jnanam Chayara Haitukam. Haitukam means it comes naturally, free gift that you get. And when one has that, the Srimad Bhagavatam says, these two gifts that come as prasad from the Lord, they fortify one in the practice. So, Sutta goes on to say, Tachchadadhana munayo jnana vairagya yuktaya paschantyatmani chatmanam bhaktya shuta grihitaya. That one becomes then fortified with these two things. He says, you need these two things in order to advance in bhakti. You need knowledge and you need detachment. And then he says one more thing. You also have to be thoughtful. You have to be a little thoughtful. Thoughtful people can get a lot more out of life and be less of a burden to others as well. That's why we call them thoughtful. And so knowledge, detachment, and thoughtfulness, these are three priceless items for advancing in spiritual life and the process of bhakti. Now the benefit of bhakti is if you practice bhakti, then you'll automatically get these. It's thrown in with the practice. Others who try to independently culture knowledge or detachment go through a lot of trouble, Krishna says in the Gita. Klesho dikartarastesham avyakta sakta chetasam avyakta hi gatir dukam dehavadvir avapyate. That there's a way in which one may try to detach oneself artificially from the world. This is very troublesome because it's not our nature to be detached. Does anybody here like to be renounced particularly? Well, I'll give you specifics. Do you like to not eat? Anyone? I mean, it's kind of nice to fast every once in a while, isn't it? But one of the reasons it's nice to fast is because you appreciate much more the eating process. The next day or whenever you stop fasting, it's like, wow, I'm really happy to be able to eat at all. Be able to appreciate that. But it's not natural to be detached. It's not natural to ignore people. For instance, sometimes families have a dispute. It happens a lot. In close quarters, you only hurt the ones you love. You get too close. And you might have an argument over some kind of a debt. Yeah, let's say a debt. I mean, this happens all the time when the parents leave and then the other family members have to work it out and what to do with their estate, and then they become estranged for life over some money issues. Or there can be even much smaller issues, just a harsh word. And then one is obligated to ignore the family members for some time. Or even if someone has a friend or a spouse and you have an argument, is that possible? You don't have to laugh too hard. Possible. These things happen due to social intercourse. There's a way in which there's friction amongst living entities. And I may then decide to... Of course, I don't recommend this. It's not recommended in for relationship building. Ignore the person. But people do that. People just say, well, stop talking to them. How long can they do that for? What's the world record? Many years. Yeah, it's possible. We've seen it. Hatfields and McCoys have been going at it, apparently, for centuries. You don't know who that is, right? Anyway, they're famous in American history, the Hatfields and McCoys. And family members, sometimes they'll say, I'm not going to talk to my daughter, married the wrong guy, or whatever it was. I mean, it can be anything. And I just stop talking, and it could go, I don't know what the Guinness Book of World Record is for ignoring people and not talking to them. But it could be upwards of 20, 50 years. Is that a pleasant experience for anybody involved? Is a kind of forced renunciation. I won't talk. I'll ignore. On the other hand, we actually want relationship. We want to relate to people. We want to love them. And restricting that is very unnatural. Renouncing is not our nature. We don't like to renounce. We could go on trying to prove that, but for the sake of my argument, do you agree? Anyone who doesn't agree, raise your hand and we'll make sure that you don't get any prasadam for that. And we'll observe you for the next 12 hours and see how you're doing. So bhakti doesn't advocate renunciation. It advocates adding something to what we already have. Renunciation comes naturally because one gives up the lower taste for a higher taste. And there's definitely, it's proven over many generations, there's definitely a way in which that anyone can attain a higher taste. That is a spiritual taste from rising above the complexities of the three modes of material nature. That's what causes the problem. And also my own activities that are misguided and for which I receive a reaction, either subtle or gross, are the cause of my problems. It's good to know, isn't it? That there's a central cause to all misery in life. It comes from one place. And the weird thing is that I'm doing it to myself. Who's causing it to me? Is it God punishing me? Is it something? No, you have freedom and you did it to yourself. That's a shocking revelation. In fact, the Avanti Brahmana, who's a very famous figure in the Srimad Bhagavatam, after he had gone through some of the toughest times anyone could go through in life, he had lost everything. He lost his family, he lost his money, he lost his reputation. It was because he was a miser, but after he did, because in his normal material life, he had performed some sacrifice in order to advance materially, but within that, for just an iota of time, he had prayed to God sincerely, even just for like a fraction of a second. And after he lost all his material possessions and connections, the one thing that was left was that one iota of sincerity. That never goes away. Once one makes one tiny glance towards the Supreme and says, yeah, that's what I want. Even if you completely forget about it, that is indelible. It's never lost. Therefore, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, Neha bikramanashosti pratyavayo navidyate svalpam apyasya dharmasya trayate mahatobayat. That is that if you do the tiniest, if you make the tiniest gesture towards the Supreme, even if you don't know who the Supreme is, out of sincerity of your heart, which is altogether possible because we're spiritual beings underneath all the coverings of the modes of material nature, but if you make even the slightest gesture towards Krishna, he says that goes on your permanent record eternally, and it also gives you an advantage eternally, just the tiniest gesture towards the Supreme. And so when he did that, and then got re-engaged in his material life, and then everything went south. Everything he had, he lost. That remained in his heart, and it grew. And he developed an intention to walk towards the Supreme Personality of Godhead in his life. In fact, he repeated a prayer wherever he went. Etam sastaya paratmanishtam adyasitam purvatamar maharshibi aham tarishami durantaparam tamom kundangrin sheva yaiva. I shall cross over the insurmountable ocean of material suffering by being firmly fixed in the service of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This was approved by the previous acharyas who were fixed in service to the Supreme Lord, Paramatma. And so I'm just going to tell you about his troubles because it's nice to hear about other people's troubles, isn't it? That's what a lot of movies are about. Definitely there's a whole genre of music called the blues. It's all about how bad my life is. If it wasn't for one of the refrains from a famous song, if it wasn't for bad luck, I wouldn't have no luck at all. And so this Avanti Brahmin had lost everything, and then he began to realize many things as he turned towards Krishna in his life. And he got this knowledge and detachment. And here's one of the gems of knowledge that he got. He actually was in the palm of his hand. He could look at it anytime he wanted. And that was, all the miseries that are in my life, I've caused for myself because of my previous activities. And therefore, and from that, he developed the quintessential attitude which allows one to advance in spiritual life. Shall I say what it is? And I'll tell you what he said. He said, if one bites one's own tongue, possible, right? Please say yes.
Yes.
I do it all the time. If one bites one's own tongue, whom can one blame other than oneself? Right? You bite your tongue, it's like, call your wife, get in here. Why'd you make me do that? In fact, people do that sometimes. But it's ludicrous. You bit your own tongue, and live with it. You know, it happens. You bit your tongue. So in a similar way, he said, I'm experiencing miseries. I'm experiencing a reversal of fortune. Where did it come from? It came from me. I'm responsible. If one takes that kind of responsibility, then there's an answer. There's a way out. And this is the bedrock of advancement in civilized life. And that is giving up victimhood. I'm not a victim. I'm an independent soul. I have freedom to move about the country. And therefore, I'm going to take responsibility for whatever I have now. And as soon as one does that, one can then move forward. And therefore, Brahma, who's the leader of our sampradaya, gives us the quintessential attitude for everyone in the famous verse in the 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, in which he says, Tate anukampam susamikshamano punjana eva makritam vipakam hridvagvapurvir vidadam namaste jivete yomukte pade sadaya bhak. And that is that one should be completely optimistic about achieving success in spiritual life, because one knows, one has studied carefully the nature of our original divine source, Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And that it's summed up in one of the prayers that we say frequently when we say, Hey Krishna Karuna Sindo Dina Bando Jagatpate. So what does that say? It says he's an ocean of mercy, which means, mercy means that someone who's in a position to do so waives the normal law or rule and says, okay, I'll give it to you anyway. Even though you broke the law, even though you don't deserve it, I'm giving it to you anyway. That's what mercy means. We like mercy, right? Say yes real loud. That's the part you always say real loud, you know. Yeah, we need that. So Krishna, what is he? The ocean of mercy. It means it's unfathomable how much mercy he has. And then also, Dina Bando, which means he's the friend of the fallen. Dina means fallen. So someone is fallen. What does it mean to be fallen? It means I can't help myself. I'm helpless. So he's the friend. You really need a friend when you're completely helpless. When you're totally out of it, everyone else shuts you out, Krishna's there. See, Dina Bando Jagatpate. So, if one can get this mercy from Krishna, then even a modicum, actually, Brahma later on in his prayers, he says, Atapite deva padam bujatoya prashana leshanu grihita eva hi janati tatvam bhagavan mahimno nachanya eko picharam vachinvan. And that means that if you can get a lesha of mercy from Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, then everything that you could possibly desire becomes available to you. Not only that, you can be fully aware of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna. From Alesha, say Alesha. What is Alesha, by the way? Well, let's say, if Somebody about an hour ago walked through here, and they were wearing some sandalwood on their body, let's say. And they walked through, and some molecules come off from that sandalwood, and they're floating around in the environment. And one molecule happens to come into your purview, into your nostril. One molecule. That's alesha. It's the tiniest little measurement of something. So it says, prasada leshanu grihita evahi. If you can get even just a molecule of this mercy from Krishna, who's the ocean of mercy, then everything will be known to you. So Brahma says, therefore, you should be completely optimistic in your life that you could get that. Because Krishna wants to give it to everybody, and all I have to do is position myself in such a way that I can get that. So now, the next question comes, what's the positioning? And that is the main way in which bhakti yogis conduct themselves. They position themselves in order to catch that mercy that comes down. It comes down. It's already available. It's our birthright to get it. But how do you position yourself to take advantage of it? That's the big question. So he says, tate anukampam susamikshamano bunjana evatma kritam vipakam. And that second line means that you give up victimhood altogether. That I'm not a victim. I'm actually a self-determining living entity. And whatever I have now is a result of what I've done in the past. So any kind of adverse situation that enters into my life, I say two words, Krishna's arrangement. In fact, everyone, you could say that. Yeah, just try saying that whenever anybody says something. Hey, your house just caught on fire. If you can say that, Brahma said, joyfully, well, you don't have to be joyful, you just have to say it. If you can do that, he says, you're in the right position to take full advantage of Krishna's mercy. Full advantage of Krishna's mercy. Yesterday when we went to the little Krishna kids, I don't know what to call it. It was like a huge event. It was in a football stadium or something like that, full of people. The little Krishna kids, what Bali Mardan and Ananda Vrindavan have developed over some time, they and their team, is amazing. Hundreds and hundreds of families and kids and everything like that in this. It wasn't football, it was a basketball stadium, but it was full of people. And on the way in there, there were tables with books, and there was one that had cookies in it, and they had little labels on them. So I looked at the cookies, and the label, it said Krishna's Arrangement. Thought that was a good name for a cookie, because even if it goes bad, you know, it's a bad cookie. This is really terrible. He's like, yeah, it's Krishna's Arrangement. That's such. I take that back, because actually that's illegal to do something, you know, whimsically and then claim it's Krishna's Arrangement. But it's funny anyway. I mean, the cookies were funny. So then he says, Hridvagvapurvir vidadam namaste, and that is that here's what you should do. We talked about how you should position yourself mentally, your attitude. And that is, don't be a victim, but accept that everything's Krishna's arrangement, and that whatever comes to me, whatever I have now, is a result of what I've done by using my God-given volition, free will. So then he says, go on with your activities in bhakti. Bhakti yogena sevate, services. So what kind of ways in which can you go on? He says, Hridvagvapur viradam namaste. Hrid, right? Maybe we should take a look at it, please. 10:14:8. We'll have that for you in 7 seconds or less, or your money back. There it is. Okay, scroll down a little bit. Good. Chrit means the heart. So if you put your heart into it, we really are driven by our heart. So if you put your heart into your service, chrit vak. Vak means words. The words are very powerful. And if you just engage your words, your tongue, in the service, in bhakti seva, seva to Krishna. And vapur bhi, which means and the body. Avidadam and namaha means offering obeisances. So here's the things that you do in bhakti. You use your heart, you use your words, and you use your body to offer obeisance to the original divine source, Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And just as a refresher, how would one use one's words in as an act of a very high practice of yoga called bhakti practice, and how would you use your words to do that practice? Chant. Yeah, what would you chant? Prayers. You could recite prayers. There are different kinds of prayers. There are notable prayers. There are spontaneous prayers that one can say. The spontaneous prayers, Prabhupada describes as, Krishna, my life is messed up in all these different ways. I'm admitting it, he says. I'm admitting it to you. Who else are you going to tell? I mean, nobody else can really fix it for this. Oh, that's too bad. But I got to go. But Krishna's right there. And you can say, Krishna, I'm really messed up, and it's really, really a problem. I know it shouldn't be, but it is. And, you know, could you just, like, help me or empower me in some way? This is a kind of prayer. It's very fulfilling. And then there's a notable prayers that you can take right out of the scripture, and then you can take them as your own. There's no plagiarism in spiritual life. If you go to university and you use somebody else's words, in fact, there's a formula. If you use a sentence and it has a certain percentage, it's over a certain percentage of usage of the same sentence they used, or the same paragraph, then it's a serious thing. You can be fired for that. But in spiritual life, you're free to plagiarize. You get these prayers and you just take them, and it's like, make that your own. Just say it over and over again. So those kinds of prayers you can adopt. One that I got early on was from a book called the Shriya Upanishad. And if you don't have this book in your house, you should feel a little bit worried right now. You get this book. Shriya Upanishad is extremely important. And the last prayer in the book says, O my Lord, as powerful as fire, omnipotent one, now I offer you all obeisances and fall on the ground at your feet. Please lead me on the right path to reach you. And since you know all I've done in the past, please free me from the reactions to my past activities so there will be no hindrance to my progress. This is a beautiful prayer. One can take that prayer. You can say it as much as you like. And from that, your heart will be engaged and your words will be engaged in bhakti. So chanting and saying prayers. And if you repeat the names of Krishna, we did this the other night. We went down to the Lytton Plaza and we just set up a festival down there. And the centerpiece of the festival was a group of devotees who come together to chant Krishna's names. And you'd think that, you know, if people walked down the street and they heard you singing a song and you kept singing the same line over and over again, they'd think the record's broken, something's wrong. They think. But we're saying the same mantra again and again. It's 16 words, 32 syllables, but people can't leave. They're mesmerized by it because it's a transcendental mantra. And both the singers in happiness increases as they're sitting there. They can't stop smiling and feeling ecstasy. And then the people who come by to listen are feeling the same ecstasy. It's expanding. And they're both, the singers and the listeners, are looking at each other wondering and saying, what's happening here? How is this happening? But they feel it directly for themselves. Thank you very much. Shriya Upanishad. Hi, I'm Vaisheshika Das. I recommend Shirsh Upanishad. After a hard day at the office, I come home and read this book. This is our product placement. Yes, this book's available, apparently. And one can take a copy. You can take a copy and just give a donation. There's no minimum and no maximum either. So, vak, it's very important, the words we speak. In fact, you know, there are proceedings going on, political proceedings going on right now, where people are questioning whether a certain political official had said something to obstruct justice. And one of the big questions is, did he say it under... one of the big designations is if one says it under oath or not. If you say something under oath, you take an oath. You say, I promise to tell the truth. And then afterwards, you make a false statement under oath. It's very serious. Very serious. You can go to jail for, you lose your job, go to jail. You said it. It matters. It makes a huge difference. So vak, does everyone say vak? Yeah, the God of speech and our speech, it's creative. What we say matters. It really matters. Nowadays, there's a lot of speech flying around, and people feel like, I can just say anything. It doesn't matter. But it does matter, and that's what this verse is saying. It really matters what you say. And if you just concentrate on this one point, what one point? The tongue. I mean, take a look at it in the mirror next time. You barely ever take a chance to look at your tongue. You just take a look at it. It's a little rudder. It's shaped like a rudder in a boat. It's what it actually our speech throughout our life is what determines our direction, the way we're going to go. And the Padma Purana, one of the most important bhakti scriptures, gives this astounding statement: Atashu Krishna Namadi Na Bhaved Grahyam Indriye. Sevan mukihi jivado swayam eva spratyada, which takes us back to this idea of seva, right? We wanted to know what kind of service we can do in bhakti in order to rise above the modes of material nature. And here, this verse also uses the word seva, and here's the astounding part. Are you ready? If you don't want to be astounded, cover your ears. Okay. Yoga begins with the tongue. Jihwa means the tongue. Adao means begins. So all yoga starts with the tongue. And if you concentrate on this one point, vak, how you use your speech, you can be elevated above the three modes of material nature by that process. And some people take vows of no, I won't say anything. But in bhakti, again, we don't do anything unnatural. Because to not talk is unnatural. Tongue wants to move. Just make it move in the right way, and then your boat will go in the right way as well. Hridvagvapurvir, so then the body can be used also in bhakti. And how can the body be used in bhakti? You can use your hands, yes? To be more specific, here's a mantra I learned many years ago in St. Louis, Missouri. There was a restaurant there called Govinda's. It was a part of the temple. And the temple president was a very practical person. He would invite people, if they couldn't afford to buy a meal, then he had a sign on the wall. And then it said, if you want to eat here but you can't afford it, then we have a process called Shravanam Kirtanam, and the Shravanam Kirtanam means hearing and chanting, the two first processes of bhakti. And then he put Scrubanam Mapanam. So if you want to help wash the dishes and, you know, do these kinds of things, and actually Shravanam Kirtanam, Scrubanam Mapanam, or Sweepanam Mapanam. Someone told me I had the mantra wrong. Sweepanam Mapanam, Scrubanam Mapanam, These you can use your hands, you can use your legs. Every sense can be used in bhakti seva, starting with the tongue. And if you engage the tongue properly, and if you do, and it's hard, it's really hard to control the tongue. But it can be done through bhakti, because as we sing every day, we sing these prayers before we honor what we call honor prasadam. Most people say, let's eat. We say we're going to honor prasadam. It's a way of framing what we're doing in life. And we're not just eating. We're honoring prasadam. Prasadam is food that has been lovingly cooked and offered to God. And then we honor it as the remnants. And it's spiritual. It's the same vibration as the chanting. So we honor that food. And when we do that, we engage the tongue. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur wrote this prayer that we recite in these ISKCON temples all over the world. And that is that the tongue is the most voracious, look up voracious, and difficult to control. All the senses, he said, are networks of death, networks leading to death if you don't control them. They'll just drag you into the next life, which means you're going to die and take another rebirth in the material world. And he said, of all the senses, the tongue is the most voracious. And here's what voracious means, by the way.
So voracious is an adjective, wanting or devouring great quantities of food, like he had a voracious appetite. The second meaning is having a very eager approach to an activity, his voracious reading of the literature. And the origin is middle of the 17th century from the Latin vorare, which means to devour.
Devour?
Yeah.
To devour.
Devour.
Yeah. Devour.
Yeah, to devour. That puts some imagery in one's mind, doesn't it? Devouring. So if you take prasadam, you can engage the tongue, which is the first process in bhakti. And then finally, he says, does Brahma, that anyone who lives like this, jivaita, means you organize your life. You live in this way. Yamukti, anyone who, mukti pade, they put themselves in the position for liberation. And here's the very strong ending to this verse, daya bak. This is practically a legal term, which means that you become an inheritor. And what do you inherit? You inherit the spiritual world. You'll inherit the kingdom of God, basically. And so that's what's required, that one develop this attitude and one go on in spite of any and all circumstances in one's life, engaging one's heart and what else? Words and body in seva, and doing seva for Krishna. And if you do that throughout your life and you just run out the clock on the field, stay on the field, run out the clock, you'll inherit the kingdom of God. Therefore, Sridhar Swami, the ancient Bhagavatam commentator, when giving his opinion on this verse says, or his astute commentary, that is, the first duty of anyone engaged in bhakti is to simply keep one's practice alive. One way or another, you have to invent a way to keep yourself alive in Krishna consciousness. And Rupa Goswami echoes this, yena tena prakarena Krishna mana praveshayat. And that means that somehow or other, you invent a way to stay in the process of bhakti. And it's interesting, sometimes one may experience vacillations in one's practice. Possible?
Yes.
It's possible, right? So even when you're in the lowest ebb, the lowest of positions in your bhakti, and you think that I'm practically doing nothing, if somehow or other you can find even one tiny thread to cling on to keep going, you'll be successful. You keep going. And that's the spirit of this verse. Somehow or other, stay alive. You keep it going. Keep the vibration going. And that's what we started by mentioning, it that if you just keep the vibration going in your life somehow or other, then you'll advance in devotional service. Now I'd like to hear from you. We will take reflections, which means anything that you heard so far, that's stuck with you, that seems like you could use it or pass it on to others, or if you have a question. Yes. And put a microphone over on this side too. Victoria's next. Yes.
Hare Krishna Maharaj, it was a nice class. I like the point where you said Puna Puna Char with Charananam. It's the same thing in a different packaging. So that's something that stuck to me.
Yeah, something to keep in mind. And there's an example that Prabhupada gives about a prisoner. The prisoner can have a choice of iron shackles, silver shackles, or gold shackles. Which do you think is best? Sri Vatpana Prabhu said none of them. But there's a way in which I accept various circumstances in my life, some of them to be better and some of them to be worse, but it's all a binding force. And so similarly, I may be conditioned by the lowest mode, tamas, which is called the abominable mode. It really turns things on their head. Or the mode of passion, which is the mode of intense activity, and no matter how much I get, it's not enough. And the mode of goodness, where I experience a modicum of wisdom, tranquility, peacefulness, and so forth, but I'm still attached to the experience of being in the material world and tasting that mode. All of them are binding forces. That's why they're called gunas, they're ropes. I'm tied by those things. Someone has to rise above them all. Yes, Victoria.
It's so nice to know that even a small gesture towards Krishna will be remember it always, even if one forgets it.
Yeah, even a small gesture, she was remembering, that we make towards Krishna, he never forgets. In fact, there's a beautiful verse that Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu taught to Sanatana Goswami. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu appeared over 500 years ago. He is considered by the Gaudiya Vaishnavas to be the most recent incarnation of Krishna in the world, who came to show practically how to follow Krishna's instructions in the Bhagavad Gita. And he told Sanatana Goswami in his direct teachings that he gave him a verse, and that is, if someone even one time says that Krishna or Lord Ramachandra, I surrender unto you, then Ramachandra replies that if someone says it even one time and means it, from that day forward, I'll protect that person. I'll never forget it. One thing. And Vaitacharya found out that in the scriptures that if you offer Krishna Ganges water and some tulsi leaves, then he'll sell himself to you. I mean, bhakti is easy. A little sincerity, and then Krishna becomes pleased. You had a point? Yes.
The point that stuck with me.
I think that mic needs a little more juice. Is it possible? Okay, try again.
The point that stuck with me was we should not victimize ourselves.
Yes. Victimology is an interesting science. Some people major in it. As a never taking responsibility for one's life, you can always blame it on somebody else. And then, of course, any self-help program will start with this idea, that don't be a victim, otherwise you lose your power, you give it to somebody else. Understand that there's a way in which you're self-determining by your directing your surrender in the right direction. Thank you. 1, 2. Yeah, go ahead.
So I got to learn today from you that whatever situation we are in life currently, it's all Krishna's arrangement.
Yeah, whatever comes to us is Krishna's arrangement. We take it like that. And whatever situation I'm in, the second line of the verse we looked at, it says, te anukampam susamikshamanu bunjana evatma kritam vipakam, which means that I've created the situation I'm in now. And it is Krishna's arrangement because he's fulfilling our desire. So our desire simply has to be redirected. And one can redirect that desire, it can refine our desires and purify them by associating with sadhus. If you associate with sadhus, then you get a taste for it, for living a life in bhakti, performing devotional activities, and then you gradually have your own taste. Yeah.
I have a quick question, Prabhuji.
Sure.
So, particular to any situation, in material life and in spiritual life, what if in ourselves we have conflicting desires? How would Krishna deal with our desires? Because both will be our desires.
Well, I'll tell you a story about Putana, the witch. And this comes in Krishna Leela, so it's very important. And that is that when Krishna was a tiny little baby, just after he appeared in the world as a little baby, there were a lot of people out to get him because Kamsa was the king, and he didn't want Krishna to live because that would mess up his position. So he was sending various kinds of wizards and kind of very powerful yogis out to try to find Krishna and then kill him. So one of the first ones to reach was this Putana. So she was actually very experienced at killing children, as what she did for a living. It was on her business card. And she also was a yogini, so she could disguise herself. So the way she pulled it off was she disguised herself as one of the other women of Vraj in the village. She looked just like one of the village women, but she was extremely beautiful. And so she came into the house, and in the village, everyone passes the kids around. Everyone's a mother. They all take care. Even here at ISV, I see. It's like, hey, where'd you get the kid? Let me just pass him around. So she came in, and the men that were in the front room saw her. She was so beautiful. They were like, yeah, go ahead. And the women also had this feeling like, yeah, it's just one of us. So she bewildered them. So then Putana went in to where little baby Krishna was sleeping. And she didn't know. I mean, she could sense something that wasn't not right for her in this situation. But she couldn't know because Krishna has this potency by which he can cover himself. And so when she came in, she sensed something that, like, this is like a sword inside a sheath. You can't see the sword, but it's something going on here. And Krishna closed his eyes. And the acharyas say there's several reasons he did that. One, he didn't favor the idea of killing a woman, even though she was a demoness who came to kill him. And she picked up baby Krishna, and she had this diabolical scheme. The most nurturing of all activities, she turned into a deadly attempt to kill him. She put the worst kind of poison on her breast, nipple. And she picked up the little baby and said, here, nurse. And so Krishna took the nipple in his mouth. He sucked out the poison, which didn't affect him. Then he sucked out all the milk. Then he grabbed on hard and he started sucking out her life. And she couldn't get him off. And she was screaming. And then she assumed this gigantic form, her original form, 8 miles long, came crashing to the ground of Vraj, smashed an entire orchard of trees, which, by the way, were belonged to Kamsa, the evil king. And he, like, perfect landing, smashed all his trees. Nothing else was harmed, nobody else was harmed, just the trees. That's how Krishna arranges things. And then little baby Krishna was crawling just very merrily on the huge form of this Putana, And all the residents of Vrindavan came running to see what had happened and so forth. And this story is very important because Uddhava was one of the greatest devotees of Krishna and teaches everyone bhakti. Krishna actually personally taught him the intricacies of bhakti so he could teach it to the rest of the world. And so Uddhava says, and this comes in the second canto of the Bhagavatam, Aho bhakiyam stana kalakutam. He said, oh, this Krishna is so wonderful. Aho bhakiyam stana kalakutam. That this demoness came to kill him with deadly poison. But he accepted the part where she came as a nursemaid. And he just forgot about the other part where she tried to kill him with deadly poison. He said, who would take shelter of anybody else except Krishna? After hearing this, who would take shelter of anybody else except Krishna? Because as Prabhupada writes in his purport, he takes out of the good and the bad, he takes the good and forgets the bad. And he takes the good part, even if it's minuscule. So Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur points out, if you have mixed devotion, he said, well, that means you have some pure devotion, because what is a mixture anyway? And the Bhagavatam is very encouraging in that way also, which says, akama sarvakama va moksha kama udarati tivrena bhakti yogina yajeta purusham param. And that is that, okay, if you have all material desires right now, or if you have no material desires, or if you just want liberation, you should approach Krishna, because he can purify everything and bring you to the highest position. So it's natural to have a mixture of desires within one's heart. It's unavoidable practically. There are only very few rare souls who appear in this world without being touched by this mixture of material and spiritual desires, some more than others. But the Bhagavatam goes on to say, Kirata hunandra pulinda pukasha abhira shumba yavana kasadaya yene chapapa yadapashraya shraya shudyanti tasmai pravavishnave namaha. This is Shukadeva Goswami speaking, and he says, you can come from the worst background possible. And he names a bunch of them. He puts them in by name. Kirata hunandra pulinda pukasha. These are like, you know, practically people who have become really degraded in various ways. He said, all these people, no problem, because bhakti is so powerful. Because it's the power of Vishnu coming through his devotees can purify everybody. So you should expect it and then go on with the process and diligently employ the system of bhakti yoga in your life, and then the purification will come. There's a lot more to be said about that. I mean, there are volumes of books written about your question, to answer your question, one of which is available now. It's by Raghunath Das Goswami. Urmila brought it to light recently, and it's called The Manak Shiksha. And in it, it describes the various ways in which one may be affected by desires and unwanted influences, and how one can get out of those to come to the pure state of bhakti. Is everyone all right? You need more air? Can we get, who can arrange more air? What? Ramananda Sakha Prabhu? He has a connection with Vayu. Vayu is the god of air and wind. What's that? He said it'll cost you. No, I couldn't hear what you said. Oh, okay. All right, well, whatever you decide. But I have a feeling that the more air we get, the more brain capacity we'll have. Okay, you had a couple points back there?
Hare Krishna Maharaj. So in the class, you were telling about that, you know, the renunciation and knowledge, it comes along with the practice of bhakti. But also we see in some of the Shastras written by our Acharyas and also different Puranas, it is mentioned like you perform different prath for for the sake of bhakti also, like Damodar breath, this Ekadasi breath very strictly, so that you get some, you know, juice of bhakti. And also we see in Srimad Bhagavad Gita 17th chapter that like austerity in terms of goodness, passion and ignorance. But there is not much detail about, you know, austerity in terms of pure mode of bhakti, or, you know, beyond the mode of this material nature. So how can we understand that austerity is what we are doing, or tapas we are doing, it's actually bringing bhakti, not, you know, something external, in context of the teachings of our acharyas?
Yeah, well, context is important, because actually we perform activities that are pleasing to Krishna, and in that context, they may appear to be austere, because we're doing what Krishna likes rather than what I like. And austerity means to delay gratification. So it just takes a little practice to delay gratification when one's engaging in the activities of bhakti. But actually, the response from Krishna is so immediate, and the process is so joyful anyway, that it hardly seems like austerity at all. If one is holding one's senses back just for the sake of trying to hold them back and not for pleasing Krishna, that's when the real austerity begins. Real austerity means the real trouble and sense of despair and the feeling that one's holding oneself back. But all these activities that you mentioned, like performing the Damodar Vrat, actually, if you read the Damodar, the Kartik Mahatmya, you'll find pages and pages glorifying offering a lamp to Krishna. Is that very difficult? Is it? Not so, but it could be a little bit of an inconvenience, because you might, you might do it 3 days and think, oh, well, now, you know, the fights are on the fourth day, so I'd rather watch the fights, right? I mean, there could be so many other things that one has to do rather than go to the temple and offer a lamp to Krishna. 30 days is a long time to make a vow for something. And so, say, on the fourth day, you know, friends come over and say, let's watch the fights. And you say, I can't, I got to go offer a lamp. That's austerity for the sake of Krishna, but it's very nice activity. It's not that you're left hanging there, it's just sitting in a closet with your eyes closed and thinking, I wish I was watching the fights. But you're actually, you know, you go into the atmosphere of the temple, and it's very beautiful, and the offering the lamp is very fulfilling when you see Krishna there, and the music and the song. So it's not really very austere. The six Goswamis of Vrindavan were noted for austerity. They were showing a very special example, actually, because they came from very aristocratic backgrounds. And it's one of the ways in which Chaitanya Mahaprabhu chose to display to the world the power of bhakti, that by performing these devotional activities, one no longer cares for the senses in various ways, because you have a higher taste. And so, as you know, the quintessential verse in the Bhagavad Gita is Vishaya Vinivartante Niraharasya Dehina Rasavarjam Rasopyasya Param Drishva Nivartate, which means that when you get a higher taste, the lower things go away automatically. So there's a modicum of austerity or regulations in bhakti, but the main point is Yena Tena Prakarena. Yena Tena means whatever way, any way you can. What is it? Anyway, yena tena. Everyone say yena tena. Yena tena prakarena. Somehow or other, remember Krishna. So put yourself in that position. And if you do that, that's the main austerity for bhakti. And those who have a taste for it, that they like to do certain kinds of austerities, because it gives them more time to do devotional service. Like, there are certain times of the day that are better for bhakti than others. What's the time of day that's best? Brahmahorta, actually, you know, it's a little austere to wake up in the morning. I notice that, because whenever I go walking in my neighborhood early in the morning, there's nobody there, especially on Sunday. I mean, it could go really late, and people are coming out getting newspaper at like 11 in the morning or something like that. And people like to sleep in, or they get used to it. But devotees actually get a taste for waking up early because they know there's free nectar floating through the air during Brahma Muhurta. So they just get a little bowl and they get up early in the morning, they set it out there. It's like, it's free. Why would you come later when it's you got to pay a big price for it? So that's the. It seems like an austerity to wake up early, but for devotees, they're actually getting free stuff. Everyone likes free stuff, right? Free goods, yes? Not very much, just a little? Free stuff? Yeah, free stuff in, available in bhakti. So the real austerity is not really felt by the devotee. It's such a joyful process. And actually, Rupa Goswami says in his Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu that those who try to do these cutting-edge austerities, they can actually make their hearts hard. Bhakti's meant to make the heart soft. It's not meant... You know, heavy austerities that jnanis do, restricting their senses and stuff, it gives them an edge. You know, say you get a little grizzly beard and they're kind of like... They're a little bit... You know, they have a little bit mean-spirited because they can afford to be. You know, they got some sukriti from practicing the austerities, but they can get a little hard-hearted. But bhakti's not meant to become hard-hearted. In the beginning, little austerity to get some distance from the normal stupid activities in the material world. Absolutely stupid activities. Don't drink stuff that you can light with a match, for instance. It's like, duh, hey, this ignites, let's try drinking it. You know, things like that are just like, this is some basic common sense. They're not really even austerities. They're just a common sense, civilized human intelligence. But, you know, austerities for the sake of austerities can make the hard heart. So we just find out what Krishna wants. And if you do that, for instance, Krishna wants teach Bhagavad Gita. So if you arrange your life so you can teach Bhagavad Gita to all your neighbors, it's an austerity because you got to invite them over. And they'll come in your house and look around and you got to clean everything. That's an austerity too, but you're doing it for a higher cause. Hare Krishna. Yes. 1, 2.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. Thank you for a wonderful class. I was just... comment about Tatenu Kampan and the victimhood. So I was thinking that how there's a sense of entitlement that every moment either you want a victory or you want to be a victim. So either I should get success in or I didn't get. So it's the vacillation from one point to another, but it's the same ahankar. Either it is like a blown up balloon or a, you know, the balloon which has been pricked. But you feel it. So I was thinking this is so important that entitlement should go away in any sense, and it's moment by moment practice, because it could be in terms of respect, it could be in terms of interaction, it could be any, and it's such a dynamic activity. So thank you for reminding us.
Nice point. Krishna helps us to redefine what success is in the Bhagavad Gita. He says, if you go on steadily doing your practice of bhakti, do your duty, no matter what else happens, doesn't matter so much. You're successful if you just stay in the game. He says, one who goes on with the practice and doesn't consider victory or defeat, what the result is coming, that person is successful. We can redefine success in any minute, and the best way to define it is according to Krishna's parameters. And if you do that, then you won't be tipped over by this idea of achievement, success. You'll know what it is. Thank you very much. Yes, 1, 2.
At the start of lecture, you mentioned about apurusha, like the non-material knowledge. So I was contemplating on that point, that to get out of this material world, we need something higher and get connected to it on regular basis. Understanding that Bhagavatam and holy name is apurusheya and it's non-material.
Yeah, no one expects the practitioner to accept it blindly. Blind faith is not recommended. But also blind doubt, which is the opposite side, in which one becomes cynical and thinks... There is no answer. That means you think you're God because you're saying there's no answer. So what are you, omniscient? and you're just fanatically, blindly doubting that there could be a source of perfect knowledge. But the practitioner of bhakti is one through many lifetimes of experience in the material world and coming in contact with sadhus who can inspire the person's heart for the path, the middle path, which is not karma, it's not jnana, it's right down the middle of offering one's dedication, dedicating one's life to Krishna. Then one can have this perfect balance. So just a final word about one of the ultimate practices in bhakti, which is dancing. And that is, never miss a chance to dance. Because it's an activity that goes on constantly in the spiritual world. According to the Sri Brahma Samhita, Sreya Kanta Kanta Parama Purusha Kalpataravo Dhruma Bhumish Chintamani Ganamayi Toyam Amritam Kataganam Natyam Gamanam Api Vamshi Priyasaki Chidanandam Jyoti Paramapi Tarasvadyam Apicha Sayatra Shirabhi Sravati Surabhi Bhyasha Sumahan Nimeshar Jakyo Vavrajati Nahiyatrapi Samayaha Bajeshwetati Pandhamahamiha Golokamityam Vidantas Te Shantakshiti Viralachara Katipaye. And you all know what that means already, so. What it means is it's a description of the spiritual world in which every word is a song, every gate is a dance. So joy means dancing, or dancing means joy. And if you don't feel joyful, it's amazing if you dance that you'll feel that joy. Not only that, if you're carrying a lot of worries in your heart, anybody got one or two? Oh, I feel so much better. I have truckloads of them. You can pull them up. Fill storage lockers. When you dance and you put your arms in the air, if you feel like it, and dance, they'll all come flying out. And you can go home and start over again. So that's a good idea, right? So we thank you very much. Thank you very much for coming all the way out here. And now we'll put all the seats away, and we'll roll up and get ready for the evening ceremony. Hare Krishna. Natari Armarman, Natari Armarman, Natari Armarman, hey, Natari Armarman, Natari Armarman, Natari Armarman, Natari Armarman.